This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm David Remnick. The last 2 weeks on the show, we've been hearing the story of a woman's search for the biological father she never knew. Her name is Adriana Alty, and she's a close friend of Jill Lepore, a writer for The New Yorker. You can find the first two parts at newyorkerradio.org, but let me see if I can summarize it quickly. Adriana is mixed race. She was adopted into a white family in Massachusetts, and she found it difficult to talk with her parents about it.
But I am different, though. And they're like, no, you're not. And I said, but I look different. And they're like, well, you're just the same. You're just the same. And it doesn't matter if you're what color you are. You could be orange. You could be blue. You could be light. And I'm like, well, I'm not orange or blue. I'm this other color.
As a young woman, she got to know her white birth mother, whom she calls Nina in this story. Nina told her some outlandish stories about her biological father, a man named William Brown. He was a street poet in Greenwich Village in the 60s. And a favorite of Bob Dylan's. But nobody knew where he was. They didn't know where or when he was born, and William Brown is a pretty common name. So Adriana and Jill Lepore spent a long time searching for him, and they were stumped until they tried his nickname, Big Brown.
And just like doing a basic Google search for like Big Brown and Bob Dylan, he pops up.
Adriana Alty picks up the story there.
You put Big Brown in YouTube, and, you know, his album comes up.
And Adriana starts emailing me, oh, my God, I found a recording.
Here he is, the poet, with his album Between Heaven and Hell, Big Brown.
There are all these songs, and there suddenly we have his voice. And suddenly I can hear him, you know, this is him talking.
The blues rhyme there, blowing away any char of gladness. Until you find that you're like a sunken man in this ocean of sorrows and sadness.
It's a bit of a mystery when it was recorded, but it's seven tracks, and it's Big Brown. It's called Big Brown, the first man of poetry. Like, there's one that's called Me, and it starts off, the greatest cat I ever met is me.
The greatest cat I ever met is me. There's been no cat I could love or pet.
It's very, very funny poem. It's so winking and parodic, and it's just funny.
Look at me. I'm a sly, witty guy, but I maintain my high and don't love nobody but everybody.
So we had this, you know, very exciting moment where we had found this recording, and then, but of course, then there was a you know, a brief lull. So, because we went to dinner and we weren't talking about it, because we'd been talking, and we weren't talking about it. And I said, oh no, she's gonna move on. So I said, what about this Danny Fitzgerald character? What would you look into that?
So Danny Fitzgerald is a blues musician, and he lived in New York in the 1960s. And Adrian had found an album that he recorded. Talk about that time.
I'd met Big Brown in Washington Square Park. Yeah, he was a poet. What's-his-name got a lot of his stuff from him, Bob Dylan.
Right. So I said to Jill, well, can't, you know, why don't you just call Dylan?
So I got an email address for the guy who handles Dylan's email, and I wrote to him, and we thought he would talk to us, but in the end he didn't talk to us. But Adriana found something else.
Yes, I did. It turns out that he has given interviews where he talks about Brown. He said, all these black guys would come up from south of the border and recite poetry in the park. Now they call them rappers. The best was a guy named Big Brown who had long poems. Each one was about 50 minutes long. They were long, drawn-out bad men stories. Romance, politics, just about everything you can imagine was thrown into his stuff. I always thought this was the best poetry I ever heard. Now, you have Bob Dylan saying this is the best poetry you ever heard.
Yeah, that's not nothing.
That's not nothing, and that's Nina actually was what she was saying was true.
If Big Brown had been performing in Harlem, it would have been just like another guy, and people would have been like, yeah, he happens to be very good at doing it. But it stood out in a different way, I think, in Greenwich Village than it would have in a different neighborhood. In fact, it stood out so much to people who were interested in the 1960s in the study of folklore and folk life that a bunch of folklore scholars began collecting these things that are called toasts, which are these they're like braggart poems. They're these rhyming poems about – there a lot of them are about hustlers. They tend to be sexually outrageous. There's a lot about pimps and prostitutes and – they have this whole badass thing going on.
Honky Tonk Bud, the hip cat, stood, was digging a game of poo. His pants wasn't sagging, but this cat wasn't bragging because he knew he was looking real cool. He was choked up tight.
My name is Abiodun Oyewole, and I'm a poet educator.
Abiodun Oyewole was a founder of the Last Poets in 1968.
Selfish desires are burning like fires among those who hoard the gold.
So many of us who were researching the whole oral tradition situation in America, we had to go back to the toast. Just like those folks in the toast had to know something about High John the Conqueror and People Who Could Fly, which are folk tales that we brought with us from the slave plantations. And so that was really just a part of your learning process if you wanted to get down with what they call the spoken word.
And those who stole the people's gold are definitely corrupt. Credit cards, master charge, legacies of wills, real estate.
You know, I know the toasts were born basically in prison. A lot of guys would just sit around and be creative. You know, it's like you say, necessity is the mother of invention. So you don't have a TV, you don't have your boys on the block, you don't have all the things to do that you would have to do if you were not incarcerated. So you're sitting around, and your mind is still working, but how do you direct it? So guys would create stories. They would create these phenomenal stories of all these colorful characters. Of course, Durella DuFontaine was one. She could persuade you to do things that you didn't want to do and give her money that you didn't want to give, but she always came out on top.
I was standing on the corner in the middle of the square trying to make me some arrangements.
Durella DuFontaine is a toast. It's a toast that Brown was known to have performed in Washington Square Park. And in 1969, the Last Poets recorded a version of it with Jimi Hendrix.
It's that hand in the glove when you look at it. I mean, with Big Brown and Ginsberg and all the beat poets were doing down the village, it's alive and well today in more ways than one. I mean, these guys represent something that we are trying to capture now. We've got a whole generation of young people who are living, breathing, and dying with the word.
David Amram is a well-known composer and conductor and jazz musician. And in the 1960s, he was living in the village and knew a lot of the same people that Big Brown knew. He hung out with Ginsberg and Kerouac. And he tells a story about a time he brought a classical composer who was visiting from Europe down to Washington Square Park to meet Brown.
I said, Brown, this is a guy from Tondaleo. He's from Holland, and he's a wonderful composer. He came all the way over here. Symphony played his piece, and he wants to check out all of America. And Brown said, come on with me, man. So we walked over, a gesture. So he took us to the middle of the fountain. He said, here's where you're going to see and hear it all. And Big Brown says, see what I told you, man? And then he started one of his raps into Tom's ear, and Tom put his hand up to hear Brown, and then with his other hand, had on his other ear, was listening to all those great sounds at the same time. Brown had become like a sports announcer, describing all the different things that was happening, and then also giving a little rundown of the people who were playing, you know, saying that cat's from Ohio and he ran away from home and he's a songwriter and this accordion player's family's lived in the village like for two generations and doesn't speak English and went through the whole routine. And Tom said, now, he said, I've seen and heard America.
Let me say first that I accept the nomination of the Democratic Party.
One thing I found, which was very, actually very strange, and it took a while to figure out what it was Big Brown was nominated for as a presidential candidate as part of the Beat Party of America.
So I looked up in the newspaper, and it turns out there was an AP wire service story in the summer of 1960 when Nixon and Kennedy are the nominees for the major parties. There's a third party ticket, the Beat Party of America. Holds a mock presidential primary contest in Greenwich Village, and during the first round of voting, Big Brown got the most votes. So the AP wire service story reads like this: Big Brown's lead startled the convention. Big, as the husky Negro is called by his friends, wasn't the favorite sonny of any delegation, but he had one tactic that apparently earned him votes. In a chatterbox convention, only once did he speak at length, and that was to read his poetry.
No, I don't indulge in politics, but I spoke at the UN Nations on foreign situations and possible integration. Didn't nobody speak but me. I'm with the whole South Sea.
Nina had always said she didn't know whatever happened to Big Brown, but she had heard years later that he was run over by a steamroller in Hollywood and killed. And I thought, I put that in the category of crazy-ass things that Nina says that no one could possibly believe, because that is out of Looney Tunes. Like, that is not a real death. That is what happens after Wile E. Coyote drops an anvil on your head. Then Danny Fitzgerald says on this recording we're listening to on the way home, says...
And then he went to California, and he got run over.
I mean, maybe he really did get run over by a steamroller. It was really hard to find out. Adriana tracked down all kinds of people that might have known Brown. Danny knew this guy named Bill Gross. Brown once stayed in Gross's apartment, found this guy named Ned Otter. His father had taken pictures of Brown when Ned was a kid. There were pictures of Brown on the wall of his apartment. And so we asked all these people, like, what happened to him? Did he really get run over by a steamroller?
I heard that that he had been in California and been on a beach. I don't know why the name Manhattan Beach comes to my mind. I believe the version I heard was that he was got in a fight or that he was attacked at night on this beach and stabbed. And this is what comes to mind. I know Danny says he was run over, but I believe it was some kind of a violent death.
I heard he was rubbed out by mobsters. I heard he was shot during a card game, like a poker game. Shot or maybe run over.
Did you ever hear run over by a steamroller?
No.
Okay, because that's the one we keep hearing. So did you ever hear stabbed on a beach?
Nope.
Did you say, my friend, that you're not afraid on this day when you meet death? Will you tell me that when the day arrives and you take your very last breath? Now, you've got to die. You know that's true, but you say it bothers you now. Oh, I see your past.
Everyone who said anything about him, or anything I've read about him, is that he is not only is a character, but he's the kind of person that you know, if he's around, it's not like he's going to go unnoticed. In that sense, either he's gone or he's in some way so diminished from what he was that, you know, is not recognizable as the same person. So either way, this person can't be around, because how could someone like that be around and not have anyone take note?
So once we kind of really were hunkered down looking for Big Brown, I thought, oh, I should see if there's any – he's this poet. You know, there's all these collections of poetry and sound archives all over the place. So I went to, like, the obvious places, like the Woodbury Poetry Room at Harvard, and looked through their archive and just various – then I went through oral history collections trying to see if anybody – I thought, this oral history movement in the 1960s, someone surely sat this guy down and did an oral history. Came up with nothing. So then I was looking through the finding guides to the collections at New York University, which is in Washington Square. Was pouring through the Larry Rivers collection. Rivers was this kind of beat artist of some renowned and acclaim, and he was also a filmmaker. He's a painter and filmmaker.
Rivers, actually, I had known him mostly as like a painter, so I actually didn't know about this film that he'd made. He made a film, a documentary of sorts about breasts, and I was like, oh, okay, here we go. You know, this is the perfect setup for what we're going to hear is probably not going to make me very happy.
Yeah, we didn't know that it was...
Yeah, we didn't know.
We just thought it was Brown on tape.
Yeah,
we had no idea it was about breasts.
Like, for instance, if you're with the woman, isn't it mainly that you make the aggressive suckling gestures and that she very rarely... I mean, I have...
Women are looking for you continuously as hard as you're looking for them. If they like you or if they're curious about you, they are seeking you as strong as you're looking for them, you know?
You know, Larry's trying to sort of lead him down this, like, well, how do you feel about breasts? And Brown goes off in this whole sort of, well, you know, they're part of the woman, and you got to know the woman, and they're, so I'm thinking, oh, good, he's a good man. I was proud. I just felt like, oh, he was led down this path that could have been really very unpleasant to hear, and he just... It's great.
They're talking just like you talk out of your mouth.
What, breasts or?
Absolutely.
Well, what about elbows? What's wrong with elbows?
I never went out that far.
Well, that's what I'm trying to say.
But then I'm sitting there thinking, like, Rivers, just ask him, like, where were you born? What year were you born?
Right,
what's your
right.
social security number? Well, what's your actual name?
I mean, here's someone who's actually talking to him. Where's the important questions?
Like, nothing.
It's like, this is
that I want to know.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, unless a cat can play her. You know, for the sound and the rhythm and the jazz that come from her. You know what I mean? She's just, you know, just a nice girl.
I was thinking about after lunch when I said, what are you going to do now? And you're like, I'm going to go back. And I was like, why? Well, look, we already listened to it and we transcribed it mostly. And you're like, oh, I just want to listen to him.
Yeah. It's probably simplistic to say, but I mean, they make him like a real person where I've known of him, about him, since, you know, I met my birth mother, so for, almost 30 years, and I didn't ever really sort of get from her the feeling of, like, that I knew him. So it kind of has done that. And it's interesting what Lemur was saying about being in the village, and, you know, he's an artist, so he was there, and, you know, Brown was performing, he's an artist, and he was there. But there weren't really black people, that many black people. There was predominantly a white thing, but people were there because of their art and because of their, you know, what they were trying to do. And that's something that I've had, a struggle with, and that, you know, I went from being very young to going to art school where I was, you know, maybe one of two black people in the whole, practically in the whole, you know, school, or at least my class, and, you know, not just an artist, not a black artist, not a white artist, but you're just an artist.
Most of us go through life finding people and losing people and finding them again. And that's actually a big part of why I'm a historian. I like to figure out where things came from, but I also like to find things that have gotten lost and find people that have gotten lost. So this story has actually been really hard for me. Because I thought we would find him, like, find him, meet him, find out exactly what happened to him. And it's really hard to find a guy named William Brown. But I know, too, that it's meant so much to Adriana to find out what we have found. And I kind of think that she's kind of put the pieces of him back together in a way that brings him to life. She was visiting when we were kind of finishing up doing the research that we had done. And she said, I have to go home now because I've just ordered 50 pounds of brown clay. It's going to be delivered, and I have to get home because I have to be there to pick it up. And I said, okay, well, hold on, wait, like, back up. What are you going to do with 50 pounds of clay?
I decided to make some sculptures of him.
So what does that mean?
That
to,
means...
To make him...
To make him, well, you know, I mean, it means literally means, you know, putting the clay on the armature and making his face. Like, now that I know what he looks like and could sort of guess. You know, I have a lot of ideas for different things that I want to do based on, you know, him. I don't know. It has actually been a while that I've been very, you know, excited to make something. And I don't know.
So do you feel like you found him?
I do feel like I found enough to feel like I knew who he was, and it makes me very happy in a way that, you know, but when I was younger, I didn't want anything to do, you know, with that at all. And by the time I had, you know, sort of gotten old enough to realize that, you know, it's not bad to be brown or whatever, I hadn't lived as part of a black community, a community of color, and so I felt a little like I'm almost like an imposter in some ways. Like, I felt that I was, you know, appropriating something, because I didn't feel connected myself to it. And maybe that is what I'm doing, but I know that I feel more connected to it. And I feel like I, in a way, have a right to, you know, this person who's like, turns out is like a pretty great guy. You know, and I'm very happy about that. I'm happier than I would have thought that I would be. I definitely didn't anticipate that I would feel like connected to him in a way, because, you know, I met my birth mother, and, you know, she is my birth mother, but I couldn't see myself in her. And I don't know him, but everything I have heard about him makes me feel like I know him, and I feel like I am like him. I mean, I'm actually like somebody where, I mean, I've never been like anyone that I've ever known. So, you know, and still felt like that I could claim them in a way.
You are like him. I mean, I think for me to see that photograph and see how much he looks like you, and the first time you sent me the record, listening to that first track, I remember just, oh my God, how can that be inheritable? Like, you sound like him to me. So it fills in a lot for me. So I feel, in this very different way, I'm so happy to have found the best poet Bob Dylan ever knew.
When you get all you long for in your struggles in life, then the world make you king for a day. Go to the mirror and look at yourself and see what that guy has to say. For it is not your mother, your sister, or your brother whose judgment upon you must pass. The guy who counts most in your life is the guy staring back from the glass. He's the one to live up to, never mind all the rest, for he's with you, clear up to the end. And you'll pass your most dangerous, difficult task if the guy in the glass is your friend. You could be like Jack Hall and chisel a plum, thinking you're a wonderful guy. But the guy in the glass say you're only a bum if you can't look him square in the eye. You could fool the whole world down the pathway of years and get pats on your back as you pass. But your final reward would be heartaches and tears if you cheated the guy in the glass. To thine own self, be true.
New Yorker staff writer and professor of history at Harvard, Jill Lepore, talking with her close friend, the artist Adriana Alti. And Bob, if you're listening and you want to come on the show and talk about Big Brown, just give us a ring.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.